I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. Americans are divided over most things, and the past is no exception. We don't agree about whether to celebrate or question the past. We fight about whether teaching history indoctrinates or educates us. We're divided about whether the full story of the past harms or helps us. For historian John Garrison Marx, the real problem is that Americans don't like ambiguity. We want to see the past in terms of heroes and villains. We're uncomfortable with shades of gray. For Marx, George Washington best encapsulates this dilemma. George Washington was, above all, a man of irreducible contradictions. He was the most important founding father, the icon of a nation devoted to liberty, equality, and democracy, yet he was a slave owner to his dying day. George Washington was a supporter of gradual abolition. He freed all his slaves in his last will and testament, yet he never took a public position on slavery during his lifetime. George Washington was maddeningly ambiguous. How we remember him and his legacy of slavery reveals much about ourselves and our understanding of what it means to be American. A conversation with John Garrison Marx about his book, Thy Will Be Done, George Washington's Legacy of Slavery and the Fight for American Memory. As always, if you appreciate the content of this podcast and want more, subscribe on the Realms of Memory YouTube channel or your favorite podcast app, send a link to a friend or family member, and review us wherever you can. John, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
First, let me say, what a pleasure to read your book. I mean, the goal of this podcast is to try to take academic research, make it accessible to a general audience. You've already done that work. This is an incredibly readable book, just a sheer pleasure to read from start to finish.
That's a relief to hear. And it's still a little bit strange to me that people have read the book, but I'm excited to talk about it.
The overarching theme of the book is that we've kind of dumbed down George Washington and his connection to slavery. At least we've simplified it. And you argue that this is kind of maybe part of an American culture where we like to see the past in clear-cut terms in terms of heroes and villains. So you start your book with background on Washington, because part of your argument is, well, he's taken out of history and he's looked at in one way or another way. And to really start with a more nuanced understanding of him, you have to put him back into history. So how do you try to contextualize him in the opening part of your book? What things do we typically not know about him?
Yeah, that's a great question. And for me, so much of what I write about in the book is how Americans have kind of cherry-picked from Washington's history with slavery in order to make a particular point in their present moment. But I realized as I was researching and writing that that readers would really struggle to see who was cherry-picking and how if there wasn't this kind of introductory foundation of what Washington's history with slavery actually was. And I say in the book that both Washington's detractors and the people who see him as the kind of ultimate American hero both kind of fail to recognize how complicated his involvement with slavery really was. So Washington was a person who was an enslaver for the entirety of his adult life. He was not just a passive holder of slaves, right? He was actively involved, intimately involved with all aspects of the institution, with buying and selling human beings, with exploiting their labor, with punishing their resistance, pursuing them when they ran away. And this was true from when he began to first own enslaved people as a young adult. And it was really true all the way through the end of his life. But at the same time, while he was so actively involved in the institution of slavery, he was also writing privately to friends and colleagues and associates about his uneasiness with his own involvement in the institution. So he would write to people and talk about how he hoped to see a plan adopted for the abolition of slavery in southern states where slavery still was. He looked at northern gradual abolition laws and hoped that they would spread to the south. He expressed a kind of personal uneasiness with his involvement in the slave trade and vowed to no longer buy and sell enslaved people as property. And then in the end of his life, in his last will and testament, when he's literally on his deathbed, he tells Martha Washington to go down to his study and to get the two copies of his will that he would that she would find there. And he looked at them both, and he asked her to burn one in the fireplace and retain the other, and that would go into force as his will. And in that document, he freed from slavery the 123 people that he owned outright. He didn't own all of the people who were enslaved at Mount Vernon. Some of them were owned essentially by Martha Washington, and he didn't have control over them. But the people he did own outright, he said that they would be free after he died and after Martha Washington died. And all of these things are true at the same time. I think it's really tempting, and people have done this throughout American history. They do it still today, to see this as a kind of redemption story, right? That he was born into a world in which slavery was the norm, and then he participates in this revolution to found a nation that is dedicated to the principles of liberty and equality. And then he sees the error of his ways, and it leads to this final redemptive moment on his deathbed where he frees the people that he enslaved. But that's just too simple. It's too simple of a story, and it's not really what his involvement with slavery was. And I think a great example of that is how he interacted with enslaved people and the institution of slavery while he was president in Philadelphia. So while he is president in the 1790s, he brings 9 enslaved people with him to Philadelphia. He knows he's going to have this very public role as the first president. He had for his entire life relied on the labor of enslaved people in his daily life, and was expected to continue that as president. But the problem was that the state of Pennsylvania in 1780 passed a law to gradually abolish the institution of slavery. And that law said that any enslaved people who remained in residence in Pennsylvania for at least 6 months would be entitled to claim their freedom. And Washington learned that this law would even apply to him as president. And he schemes privately to make sure that the people he enslaved in Philadelphia were brought out of the state before they reached 6 months, and then brought back into it to kind of reset the clock. So he is actively undermining this gradual abolition law at the very same time that he is writing to other people saying how much he supports these efforts to gradually abolish slavery, and how important he thinks these legislative efforts are, and how he hopes that they will spread to Virginia. And so that, to me, kind of embodies this contradiction that is always present when we talk about Washington's involvement in slavery.
Yeah, and again, I was surprised that the scale of his involvement. That's what you stress, that he's not just involved; he's involved at a level that's unusual. That he has a large number of slaves. His wife brings even more into the marriage, and he is actively involved. If we think of presidents, at least traditionally, having to detach themselves from their business affairs once they're in office, he's actively involved. He's following his affairs back home on the plantation. And you don't try to pull any punches. You point out, not just in the case of Philadelphia and rotating the slaves in and out of there to try to escape this gradual abolition law, but he is nasty in his assessment of his slaves. If he has a particular slave who escapes, and he goes to great lengths to try to track her down. So you're not pulling any punches to the extent to which he was really involved in that business.
Yeah, I really tried in the book and in my research to immerse myself in that record, in the history, in that evidence, to really understand how he was interacting with the institution of slavery, what the level of his involvement was. And it's really surprising to see the kind of minute detail that he is involved in, even while he is leading the revolution and serving as the first president. He is always getting these reports back from his estate managers at Mount Vernon that are updating him about crop yields and about weather and about the kinds of labor that the people he enslaved were doing. And not only is he giving directions back about how to manage the estate and how to put these people that he enslaved to work, he's also complaining about how much work they are doing. And he really reveals these kind of casually racist attitudes that he has towards the people he enslaved, this real doubt that he expresses that these are people with any intelligence, that these are people who are capable of surviving in freedom. So when he gets reports, for example, that a certain enslaved person has been sick for several weeks or has been complaining of asthma, you know, he writes back and says, you know, laziness is, I think, his principal ailment, right? When enslaved people make mistakes, he denigrates their intelligence and says, you know, it would take him a month to build a chicken coop. And so it's really fascinating that he recognizes the dynamics of enslaved labor, because enslaved people did resist slavery in these small ways. They would pretend not to understand directions. They would work slowly. They would feign illness. They would run away for short periods of time as a way of reclaiming some control and agency over their own lives. And Washington recognized that they were doing all of these things, but could not recognize that this was a way of them resisting their condition. And so he saw it as this kind of intrinsic failure or as these character flaws among the people that he enslaved.
I guess one of the things that I was a little bit, I had mixed feelings about when I was reading that section is because I think in American culture, we tend to think of slavery in terms of the 19th century and the Deep South, the cotton industry. And you're pointing out that this is really a different era of slavery. And you're talking tobacco, Virginia, end of the 18th century. And if we look at Washington as a businessman, and he's clearly trying to get, squeeze every bit of he can out of his resources, this is kind of like a dying industry. So on the one hand, I was reading that, yeah, he's torn over the institution, but he's also a businessman. It's losing money. It's easy. It's maybe, I mean, I don't, could you look at it that way? It might've been easier for himself to divorce himself from the institution because it wasn't that profitable.
Yeah, certainly slavery in the Chesapeake is declining at the end of the 18th century. Tobacco takes an unbelievable toll on the soil, and there are these wild swings in the market price for tobacco, and it just wasn't a reliable cash crop for these tobacco planters and enslavers. Washington himself recognizes that pretty early and shifts towards producing other kinds of crops like wheat and other grains. But he still complains several times throughout the last decade or two of his life that that he enslaves, you know, almost twice as many people as he can profitably employ, he says. But he still is opposed to just selling those people off and separating enslaved families. But he says, you know, I have to find some solution or I'm going to be ruined, right? So he recognizes the kind of bad financial bet that slavery represents at the end of the 19th century. And other planters in Virginia and in the Chesapeake do as well. And they're also actively involved in the revolution, many of them. They are kind of embedded in this world that is so committed to the new nation and to its ideals and to the values of the Declaration of Independence. So you have people like Washington, like Jefferson and others who at least see and comment on the inconsistency of leading this new nation that is founded upon the principles of individual liberty and equality among men, while also owning their fellow man as property. They recognize that this is wrong and this is hypocritical and this is inconsistent. If you fast forward 30 or 40 or 50 years, that goes away, right? The planters and enslavers of the 1840s and 1850s, they're talking about slavery as a positive good for enslaved people. They have fully kind of dispensed with this idea that there is any inconsistency here. And that is tends to be the version of slavery that we think about today. We think about, as you say, the Deep South. We think about cotton fields. We think about that version of slavery. And that just wasn't exactly the slavery of the late 18th century, and it wasn't necessarily the slavery of the Chesapeake. So at the end of the 18th century, there are many people who were influenced and inspired by these revolutionary ideals, and they emancipate the people that they enslaved, either immediately or in their will, like Washington did. It was never the majority of enslavers, but it was a sizable number. The free black population in Virginia skyrockets at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century. But once the cotton gin is invented, and once the United States begins co-opting land in the Deep South and expanding the nation into places like Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, and cotton becomes so, so profitable, most Chesapeake planters who were in the same position Washington was in at the end of his life begin selling the people that they enslaved to the Deep South, and they opened up what historians now call the Second Middle Passage.
Hmm. Okay. So Washington, you mentioned, is not, he has his misgivings, but he keeps them private. And you argue that he's, this has a lot to do with his understanding of the fragile nature of this new country. He doesn't want to rock the boat, but at the same time, he makes a very public statement with his last will and testament. What's unusual about the last will and testament and the magnitude it takes on?
Yeah, the last will and testament typically for an individual is a pretty dry legal document, right? It's something that you just file with the courthouse within your county in the state that you live in. And you don't really expect it to go much beyond the county clerk and your executors and maybe the people that you owe debts to or who owe debts to you. But George Washington clearly writes his last will and testament in a different way. He opens it, I, George Washington, citizen of the United States and late president thereof, right? He doesn't just say, I, George Washington, resident of Fairfax County, Virginia. So he recognizes that this is something bigger than him. And he is exactly right in that. Within weeks of him filing his last will and testament, it is being written about in newspapers and then republished in full in newspapers and pamphlets across the country. So immediately within a month of Washington dying, there is news all throughout the United States that Washington had freed the people that he enslaved. And this gets republished and reprinted, sold as pamphlets. Eventually biographical sketches begin to get added to that last will and testament. And so it was this thing that everybody in the nation knew that that he did. And I think that Washington intended it for it to be that way. He wanted people to know that he freed the people that he enslaved. But ultimately, it's something that there's virtually no discussion of in the press. There's so little discussion of it anywhere in the eulogies, in the biographies about him, in the years after his death. So you have this dynamic where it's something that everybody knows about, but nobody is willing to talk about. Because I think most white Americans, like Washington, seem to recognize that slavery was a third rail, right? It was a lightning rod in American politics. And the nation was still so new and so fragile. And now with Washington's death, the very person who was doing more than anyone else to found this nation and to hold it together as president had died. And there was real worry that this entire experiment in representative democracy was going to collapse, and that emphasizing the slavery issue and using that moment to push for an end to slavery in the way that Washington kind of sets up in his will, there was real fear that that was going to destabilize the nation. And so mostly what you see in the decade after his death, even while you have dozens and dozens of these early biographies of Washington that get published, even as his last will and testament is being republished and spread across the nation, there is virtually no discussion of his involvement with slavery, his decision to free the people he enslaved at the end of his life, or slavery's place in Washington's legacy. It's just utterly silenced.
So he uses his last will and testament as a kind of public platform, and it really does go viral. But it's buried. And this is your point that this connection, this legacy in connection to slavery, it can get emphasized or forgotten depending on the needs of the political context. And if you look at the early 19th century, there were concerns that maybe the timing was not right for that. But that changes as you approach the Civil War. So you fast forward a few decades, and Washington's relationship to slavery becomes a political football that you can use one way or the other. It's used on both sides of the issue. So how does that take shape?
It was really fascinating to dive into this evidence of how Washington gets used in the fight over slavery in kind of the 3 or 4 decades before the Civil War. And you have both anti-slavery advocates and pro-slavery advocates who are all claiming that Washington's legacy with slavery supports their position. Even among anti-slavery activists, they use his history with slavery in very different ways. So you have some people who were opposing slavery that cite Washington's deathbed emancipation of the people he enslaved to say that if Washington saw fit to free the people he enslaved, then what could possibly be more American than ending slavery? They lift up Washington as a way of pushing forward their efforts to gradually abolish the institution. But by and large, as the 19th century wears on, the anti-slavery movement grows more radical, more committed to having an immediate end to the institution of slavery. And for the radical abolitionists, they see more benefit to criticizing Washington's involvement with slavery to make clear that radical action is needed to end this institution and to root it out of American institutions. So it's really remarkable to go back and read some of these quotes from these abolitionists in the 1840s and 1850s, because it is some of the most withering criticism of Washington's involvement with slavery that you will ever see. I think everyone likes to think that they are the ones who are bringing this conversation forward for the first time. You see some of the criticisms of Washington for being an enslaver today. And a lot of times they have nothing on abolitionists like Parker Pillsbury or William Lloyd Garrison or others who were truly ruthless in the ways that they describe Washington as being a slaveholder to the day of his death. They talk about his pursuit of Ona Judge and his signing of the 1793 Fugitive Slave Law. And they say he wasn't just a slave owner, he was a slave hunter. And they also recognize what they're doing by bringing Washington into their rhetorical repertoire, right? So William Lloyd Garrison, founder of the Liberator, one of the most prominent voices opposing slavery in the 19th century, he tells a crowd in a speech at one point that he recognizes that it is more hazardous in the United States to criticize George Washington than it is to criticize Jesus Christ. And that, I think, is both true and really remarkable that he says it publicly, that he recognizes the weight of using these criticisms in their political fight to end the institution of slavery. And they're mostly correct. The abolitionists who are citing his emancipation of the people he enslaved, they cite it faithfully. The critics among the radical abolitionists who are citing Washington's history with slavery mostly are also correct. They are citing his deep entanglements with the institution, the ways that he was actively involved in slavery for the entirety of his life. And they are faithfully citing the historical record, but they're only citing part of it. And this is a dynamic that you see happening again and again, is this cherry picking of Washington's record in order to fight the political or cultural battles of the day. And it's so obvious in this fight over slavery, because you also see pro-slavery advocates who are approvingly citing Washington's involvement with slavery to build their own case that slavery is right and good. And if the federal government is going to try to interfere with slavery, they are justified in seceding from the United States and founding a new country that is dedicated to slaveholding. So in 1862, after the Civil War has started, when the Confederacy inaugurates its permanent government in Richmond, Virginia, Confederate President Jefferson Davis does it on George Washington's birthday on February 22nd, and he does it in front of a huge statue of George Washington. And he says that their cause, right, the cause of slavery, is fitly associated with the day and the setting. The Confederacy puts George Washington right at the center of their seal people. He's on some Confederate banknotes and Confederate currency, and he's on the top of Confederate newspapers. So they are claiming Washington as both enslaver and revolutionary to justify their own revolution against the United States to uphold the institution of slavery. So you have all of these different people who are engaged in this deep debate about the morality of slavery and about its future in the United States. And they all see the power of bringing Washington into that conversation to serve their purposes and to make their points.
And that's part of the forgetting of the present, because here, what inspires you, at least I've heard in part, is that you have this Black Lives Matter movement and 2020, the reckoning, the toppling of statues. And it seems like that's something new, this harsh criticism, attack on these sacred figures that represent the nation. But actually, there's a long history of this, that there are no sacred cows in this country, that no one has been off bounds, including Washington. And you point out that era leading up to the Civil War, maybe that at that point in time, criticisms were at their harshest.
Yeah, it's really remarkable the degree to which this conversation has remained stable over time. There's not many things in public discourse that you can recognize so readily from the early 19th century and then also see it in our conversations today. In the summer of 2020 and the years after, as people really reckoned with George Washington's place in public, right, in public settings, having schools that are named after him, having statues of him in public places, people were asking these questions. Demonstrators were asking these questions about, should we have an enslaver in such a place of honor? And you had this huge backlash to even the suggestion that there is maybe some different way that we should approach talking about George Washington, that maybe we should be considering his legacy with slavery more seriously as we think about his place in these public settings. And the reaction to it is as if this was being mentioned for the first time, this kind of how dare you attitude towards emphasizing Washington's history with slavery. And it looks almost exactly the same as it looked 200 years earlier when people were having this debate. And you've seen it in almost every generation that Washington's involvement with slavery comes up anytime Americans are talking about issues of race and racial injustice, which in the United States is at least every generation. There's some big peak in that conversation.
And I wonder, because you have a whole section in your book on textbooks. So if there's this cultural amnesia and we forget that that tearing down statues, attacking the founding fathers, there's a long history of this. Maybe this has to do with our education system. And you map out the evolution of the treatment of George Washington in textbooks. And it's like a story of forgetting. Forgetting at least one part of his past and elevating another part of his past. And it's a conservative story that wins out. Could you talk about that a little bit? How does the textbook treatment of Washington evolve over time? You argue that they're actually more critical of him in the 19th century than they are in the 20th century.
Yeah, it was a really remarkable chapter to research, and it felt like it was going to be an essential part of the book, because outside of the debate over monuments, so much of the controversy and conversation over the last decade has been about how we teach about slavery in schools and how we talk about slavery's place in the nation's legacy. How is it woven into our institutions? And George Washington becomes this convenient stand-in for America itself. That is a role that he plays again and again throughout our history. And there is a major conservative pushback on any mention of George Washington's involvement with slavery. So, for example, during the Civil Rights Movement, you have scholars who are spending more time investigating the history of slavery, African-American history, women's history, indigenous history, really this, this major expansion of the American story during the 1960s and 1970s. And you have some historians and some states like California who are saying, we need to add more of this new knowledge into our textbooks. We can't just keep teaching people the same thing. And even when the textbooks weren't specifically tying Washington to slavery, they were simply talking about Washington and talking about slavery kind of side by side, you have conservative education reformers and some parents and community members and elected officials who see the kind of potency of using George Washington that are pushing back and saying, this is denigrating our heroes. This is, debunking George Washington, and it's teaching people to hate America. And you see this happening in the 1960s. You see it happening in the 1990s. And then we've seen it come up again here in the 1920s. And all along, the narrative about American history has expanded a little bit, but it's always pointing to this kind of redemptive arc of the slow expansion of liberties in American society, and talking about the kind of continued struggle to make sense of George Washington and slavery just doesn't fit in very well to that. But like you mentioned, if you look at the ways that some biographies of Washington are treating him in the 19th century, there are some who really make this case front and center. They talk about his deep involvement with the institution of slavery. And actually, some of these conservative efforts to get discussion of Washington and slavery out of textbooks or out of the AP U.S. history exam and curriculum are almost wanting to bring the story back to this kind of early 19th century, purely celebratory version of him. And then more recently, you've seen states like Florida, which I talk about in the book, who sort of recognize that in this, post-2020 world, that in 2023, they couldn't just totally ignore Washington's involvement with slavery. So instead, they do what Americans have done for a long time, which is to point to his emancipation of the people he enslaved at the end of his life as a way of making clear that both Washington and America is a place, a person and a place deeply committed to human liberty. They tie it up more neatly than it was in fact, in order to be able to continue to make the claim that, that America is a nation that is dedicated to freedom.
But again, there's a kind of forgetting. We look at the politics of the present, and there's so much focus on what's taught in the classrooms, what shouldn't be taught in the classrooms. Mm-hmm. There's nothing new here. There's a long history of this. And Washington is often used as this person who at least in the classroom can help respond to the perceived dangers of a particular time period, right? And it could be the Cold War, the threat of communism. It could be just the evolution of society and more people getting to tell their story. I thought that was kind of a sad realization for me, that section, because it seems like just as the history seems to be opening up and you come out of the civil rights era, you have more groups that are able to tell their story, be part of that history, it gets shut down. It kind of peaks, and once you get to the 1990s, it gets turned around. You mentioned it's a really conservative success story. Mm-hmm. And I thought the story of the Gablers in Texas was fascinating, how they're able to kind of vet American history. And, we think of Texas versus California in the present as an ongoing battle over which direction the country is going to go in. But you really show that plays out in terms of history. And if anything, Texas wins out over that struggle for how the American past, that story is going to be told.
Yeah, it was really crazy and kind of discouraging to see how much capitalism and markets shapes how people learn the past. So Texas is such a big state with so many students, and with this centralized process for adopting textbooks, which is a really critical part of this, that if you get a textbook approved by this statewide board in Texas, it can be put into high schools or middle schools or elementary schools all over the state. And that's a lot of books that you can sell. And Mel and Norma Gabler, beginning beginning in the 1980s, they start this process of assessing textbooks and kind of grading them on their conservative bona fides, right? And if it was in a different state, textbook publishers could, you know, could have been able to ignore it. But because it is Texas, and because the Gablers take on this kind of role for themselves, they gain this outsized influence over how history gets taught in Texas schools, which is an incredible position of responsibility. And it's one they use to really steer and bend the presentation of history in a decidedly conservative direction. So one of the kind of criteria that they use to assess these textbooks and whether they are good or not is how they treat the founding fathers and how they treat George Washington in particular. And so any textbook that is really emphasizing Washington's involvement with slavery, even if it is very much true to the historical record, even if it aligns with some of the newest scholarship that was coming out, it was still a sign that this wasn't a textbook that was fit for Texas children. And because Texas has so many children and so many students, that begins to shape to some degree what kind of histories get included into textbooks and how a generation of students learns about George Washington.
So Washington becomes the litmus test for these textbooks for the Gablers. And it's also a quantity thing. How many times is Washington mentioned? Well, if you're not mentioning him enough, that means you're spending too much time on other topics, that and that's detracting from the proper focus on the founders and the proper message. You know, all these are long-standing concerns, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not focusing on the founders and that patriotic message, then you're not shoring up society. But I thought what's kind of ironic is that you get to the present moment where there's so much concern about what's being taught in the classroom. But if you're not aware of this history, you would think that liberals won the war over the past. And it's like, well, no, it's the conservative story that Washington actually, you mentioned the high point for more inclusive history is the 1990s. And after that, you fast forward to the early 2000s, Washington's name is appearing much more frequently, and it's in a much more traditional use, praising the president. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, in the present moment, we're just rooting out any last vestiges of inclusiveness from the past.
Yeah, I think that the textbook and curriculum debates are a great example of how history just doesn't move in a straight line. It never does. It ebbs and flows and goes back and forth. And even really hard-won progress can thereafter get reversed, right? So this expansion of scholarship and storytelling from the civil rights movement, it kind of builds in this commitment to multiculturalism in the 1990s. And then the utter failure of this effort to establish national history standards in the 1990s that I write about in the book and that others have written about more deeply than I do. It's really kind of this watershed moment. And there's a great study that I cite in the book that really looks at individual mentions of Washington in Texas textbooks. And from the 1990s through the 2000s, the number of times Washington gets mentioned grows, the kind of praise that he is given grows, the number of times he is pictured in the book grows, and Lincoln, meanwhile, mentions of Abraham Lincoln start to decline, and the way that he's assessed and his legacy is assessed also starts to decline in these textbooks. And you end up with this, right back at this image of a mythical and heroic Washington that is being presented to students, not just in Texas, but all over the country. There are always other places where people are encountering ideas about Washington. It's not just in school curriculum, but that has been a site of controversy over how we teach the American story for decades. And often our conversation about America is a conversation about Washington. And our conversations about Washington are a conversation about America. And that's why he becomes this central figure in so many of these different debates.
So if there's one prominent site of memory connected to Washington, it's Mount Vernon. And that seems to be a site that evolves over time. It becomes more open to the story of slavery, but it's a hard fight to get that story told. And it's a fight that's fought by the descendants of the slaves. It's fought by the NAACP. Can you tell me, well, how much, when this becomes a pilgrimage destination for American history, how much a part of this is the story of slavery, and how does it gradually get included over time?
Yeah, the story of how the presentation of slavery has evolved at Mount Vernon is such a fascinating one to me, in large part because Mount Vernon is one of the earliest preserved historic sites in the United States, right? This house and this property begins to be preserved in the 1850s. So this, you know, is long before the sort of modern museum movement, long before the professionalization of the preservation movement. It's this really early example of recognizing that George Washington's home is important to more than just the people who are inheriting it, right? This is something that is important for the entire nation, and it deserves to be saved. And really, as soon as Washington dies, this, even before it's preserved as a historic site, it becomes this site of pilgrimage for people. People are going and visiting Mount Vernon, and they are, you know, taking little souvenirs with them on the way out. They're, you know, taking part of, you know, some stone or breaking a twig off a tree. And so some of the first people who are visiting Mount Vernon are encountering slavery there because there are still enslaved people there. You know, the heirs to this site, it's Bushrod Washington, George Washington's nephew. He inherits it in the 1820s or in the early 19th century through the 1820s and 30s. And he brings a whole different kind of cohort of enslaved people to the site. And there continue to be enslaved people and descendants of those who were enslaved by the Washingtons who are either living nearby or at the site for generations. But then in the 19th century, you have descendants of people who were enslaved there who play a really instrumental role in helping to preserve the house because they have these memories and oral histories of what went where and how each room was used and, you know, how the kitchen worked or how the dining room looked. And they played this important role in assisting the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, who owned and preserved the site, in kind of recreating it the way that Washington used it. But the way that slavery gets told as part of the official story there, as it evolves into this more formalized historic site and museum, is really complicated. And as you suggest, is this really long fight. So for years, for several decades after it's preserved as a historic site and after the end of slavery in the United States, it's not mentioned in any formal way. There are still African Americans who are working at the site in some of those early decades, and people want to talk to them about their experiences with Washington, kind of not recognizing how much time has passed, not recognizing that the people Washington enslaved are long gone. And so you have some of these early guides that are willing to invent stories that they think white visitors want to hear. But slowly, as that generation of kind of African American guides begins to die out, the story of slavery starts to disappear from the site. And you get to the 1920s, when the burial ground that was used by enslaved people and former slaves at Mount Vernon becomes totally overgrown, almost disappearing at the site. And to their credit, the members of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, the stewards of this site, they recognize that that's a problem, and they want to preserve this site. They want to preserve this enslaved burial ground, and they put up one of the first markers in the United States that at a historic site that recognizes one of these burial grounds. But the marker is dedicated to the faithful colored servants of the Washington family. And so it is kind of dripping with this lost cause ideology. It is really a reflection of the 1920s and the idea that the people the Washingtons enslaved were actually these faithful servants. And it was really fascinating to research that marker because the moment when it is installed in 1929, there is utterly no mention of of it in the local newspaper. It seems there's nothing else that they left out of the local newspaper. You know, there's talks of who got appendicitis and what six-year-old had a birthday party and a judge that got a new chair. But when you bring this, you know, massive slab of marble up to Mount Vernon to install in the enslaved burial ground, there's virtually no discussion of it at all. And it's another example of the kind of local public for Mount Vernon not being ready to have this conversation yet. And then in the decades after, you start to slowly see the story of slavery expand there. But it is often Mount Vernon getting pushed by outside sources. So in the 1950s and 1960s, they say there's a sense that they're falling behind the times, or that they're becoming, you know, they're being pressured by the NAACP, and they preserve and reopen the Greenhouse slave quarters that is nearby the historic mansion. And
isn't there a permitting? Isn't there a permitting process too? I thought that was interesting, because one of the arguments for how does history open up is that you get more people that get included in the system, and they can put more pressure on the system to open up.
Yeah, you have in the 1980s, a journalist for the Washington Post, one of the first African-American journalists for the Post, or columnists for the Post, writes this essay kind of criticizing Mount Vernon for their lack of attention to the institution of slavery. The enslaved burial ground has once again become this afterthought to the rest of the tour. And this is in 1982, I think. And she writes this essay really criticizing them for their failure to acknowledge the institution of slavery. The local NAACP takes up the cause, and they bring it to Fairfax County. And Fairfax County, some of their officials recognize that, Mount Vernon is asking for a tax exemption for this new restaurant that they want to open on the site. And they use that kind of as leverage and say, you know, until you work with this group and until you do more to acknowledge the institution of slavery, you know, you may not get this tax exemption that, you know, is important to you and that you're looking for. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, the mechanisms that get used to bring these changes to fruition are not what you'd expect. And so the site opens a new memorial, a much more substantial memorial for that enslaved burial ground in the 1980s. And since then, as scholarship has expanded, there's been this steady expansion of instances of sharing the history of slavery at the site. They've done an incredible amount of research into how slavery operated at Mount Vernon. There is mention of it in labels and signs all over the site, but it is certainly not the main story that gets told there. And a lot of that work has been pushed forward by descendants of people who were enslaved at Mount Vernon. So you have this this league of descendants, people whose ancestors were enslaved by the Washingtons, were enslaved at Mount Vernon, who are still involved in working with Mount Vernon staff and encouraging them to do more, pressuring them to do more. And to Mount Vernon's credit, they've done a great deal to collaborate and work with this descendant community on some really exciting projects. So in just the past year, they've opened a new permanent exhibit in the historic area, not at the Museum and Education Center, but in the historic area, telling the stories of the lives of different enslaved people at the site. They've started an audio tour that tells the stories of individual enslaved people that is voiced by members of the descendant community. Mount Vernon has gone such a long way in how they've evolved in telling that story, and they've devoted an incredible amount of time and money to researching and telling the history of slavery. But it is still possible to go to that site. And if you want to avoid that story and just drink in the grandeur of Washington and his role in the nation, that's still possible to do. And there's a lot of people for whom that doesn't sit well, because this was a site of enslavement first and foremost. And that is not the first and foremost story that you are learning there.
It seems like you're arguing that the museum or Mount Vernon is kind of this impossible situation where it has to celebrate the history, the legacy of the founding father, and at the same time, it's trying to become more inclusive with this dark chapter from that past. And it really can't do both things. It can't be everything to everyone. And you mentioned there's a place down the road that can do a better job because they don't have that same burden.
Yeah, there's an incredible historic site that's owned by the National Trust for Historic Preservation it's the Woodlawn Pope Leahy House, was the Woodlawn Plantation. And it's much smaller. It is, they have a lot more challenges because of their small size, but they also have more flexibility in how they can do this work because of their small size and because so much of this work is done by Mount Vernon, right? As you say, you know, there are people who will always be more or less satisfied with how Mount Vernon tells this story, because as I share in the book, this is something that we've been arguing over for 250 years. And so Mount Vernon's inability to solve this intractable question is always going to leave some visitors who thinking that slavery should be talked about more or less there. But because they do such a comprehensive job of telling the story of Washington's life, at Woodlawn, they're able to take a different approach. And, you know, this is a site that was originally part of the Mount Vernon Plantation, ends up giving being given to one of Martha Washington's daughters as a smaller property. Some descendants of some of the people who were enslaved at Mount Vernon end up at Woodlawn, and they're able to take a much more social justice oriented approach to the work. They connect the history of slavery much more closely with the history of racial injustice in the present in a way that that Mount Vernon just either can't or won't do down the road. But in large part, that flexibility that a site like Woodlawn has is because there is another site that does so much of that groundwork for them. But I had a chance to talk to some of their staff while I was researching the book. And it was really amazing to hear from them that they say so many of their visitors, they go to Mount Vernon first, and then they come up the road. It's about 2 miles away up the road to Woodlawn. And many of those people come with this perspective that, yes, Washington was involved with slavery, but he freed the people he enslaved at the end. And that's the important part of his legacy. That's the important part of his story. And they're surprised that there are people who were owned by Martha Washington and enslaved at Mount Vernon that continued on in slavery at Woodlawn, who were, you know, continued to be held in slavery for years or for decades, and are kind of surprised at the forthright way that Woodlawn tells the story of slavery, because it's so different than the way the story is told down the road.
So what's your sense, John? You work closely with museums, and you have these chapters in your book where, on the one hand, if you look at textbooks, it seems like we've kind of gone backwards somewhat since the 1960s. If you look at the political context, there's a backlash as well. But then you're arguing, well, you know, museums seem to be moving forward. They're offering a more complex story. They're more engaged with the public. You point out that surveys show that people want a more nuanced, more complex treatment of the past. Do you feel like we're moving in one direction more than another?
It's hard to say right now, I'll tell you that. You know, I work for the professional association that serves history museums all over the country. And so I hear from a lot of people. And as I was finishing writing up the book, it felt like this was a story of progress, right? Of expanding community engagement efforts, a lot of work bringing the voices of descendant communities into museum work, focusing on facilitating conversations about racial injustice, about the history of slavery and its effect on the present. You know, that was all a big part of what the history field was talking about as I finished writing this book about a year ago. But that was in the end of 2025. And now we're in early 2025. Now we're in early 2026, and we've seen the Trump administration actively trying to remove and erase histories of slavery, of African Americans, of women, of indigenous people, of LGBTQ+ people at Park Service sites all around the country. I think many people saw and had a really sort of visceral reaction to, I know that I did, of the removal of the exhibit at the President's House site in Philadelphia that tells the story of the people Washington enslaved while he was serving as president. And the administration didn't like the way that that looked. They didn't align with the narrative that they want to celebrate about America, especially as we approach the 250th anniversary. And so they had it removed. And we've seen that happen not just at Park Service sites, but there's been this chilling effect that's been cast across the wider field. And so a lot of that work that I talk about in museums and historic sites doing, there's been pullback from being able to do that kind of work, not because the individual practitioners don't want to do it anymore, but because there's real fear of backlash from elected officials, from donors, from corporate sponsors and partners. There's worry that talking about this history and really leaning into that difficult work is something that is going to lead to negative consequences for them right now. And so as much as I'd like to say things are moving in the right direction right now, that's a little bit uncertain. I think the field is no less committed to doing that kind of work. I think practitioners are no less committed to doing that kind of work, but their ability to carry it out has really been hindered over the last year. But ultimately, I see the longer history here, right? I see more than two centuries of fighting over these issues. And there have always been people who want to erase Washington's history with slavery, who want to try to hide Washington's history with slavery from view, who say it's not the time to do this, or that isn't the audience to do it with. And in the end, they never succeed, right? There is always someone else there standing up and saying, no, we need to confront this history head on. We need to reckon with it if we're actually going to understand not just our past, but the issues of our present. And so I also have faith that in the long run, these histories will be shared, will continue to be told, and that museums and historic sites will be able to resume that really important work.
John, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. Really appreciated it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking with historian John Garrison Marks about his book, Thy Will Be Done, George Washington's Legacy of Slavery and the Fight for American Memory. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, send a link to a friend or family member. Subscribe on our YouTube channel, your favorite podcast app, and review us wherever you can. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.